So welcome, everyone, for our first of our three-part new series, Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther. We are calling tonight's class, when we get to the actual class component, The Rise of the Man in the Triangle Hat, the Party. So what I'd like to do for a few minutes is to weave a little bit of Jewish history, actual chronology of the events that are leading up to the story. And I believe at the end of the series, we're really going to understand why this story speaks to the condition of the Jewish people today, more so perhaps than any other story in what we call Tanakh, the 24 books of our Torah. And the simple reason is that we are right now in exile. We're in diaspora, what they call the Galut. And Purim was the very real first moments of Jewish history when we had Israel, we had a temple of Solomon, everything was going very well. Ultimately, we wind up in a place called Babylonia because of King Nebuchadnezzar. And that lays the foundation for the story that we're going to be learning about, the story of Purim, Megillat Esther. So let's look at our handout tonight. So you see that we have the Jewish years, 3338. Then, of course, we have the infamous backwards 422 before the Common Era, BCE, as Jewish people like to refer to it. And we have in that first box a number of different historical items. We have first the Churban, the destruction of Temple number 1, the ninth day of Av, Tisha B'Av. We have the rise of the great King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonians. We have Jeremiah and Ezekiel, the great prophets of the Jews. Prophecies of destruction, exile, and then ultimately prophecies of a 70-year return. Babylonian exile with the great Daniel and Ezra. Now Jeremiah, Yirmiah, had a prophecy, a neviut, which was very, very much part of our story, as we will see tonight, that 70 years from the destruction of the temple, or the rise of the Babylonian Empire, however you want to understand it, would be the Jewish return to Israel, and then Beit HaMikdash number 2, the second temple, the temple of Ezra and Nehemiah, the way it came out to be. So in the year 3387, 373 BCE, in the second box, we have this amazing king, you may have heard of him, Koresh, King Cyrus. These are all real historical figures, okay? So this is very, very close. There may be debate about some of the years involved, but the characters and the time frame is real. King Cyrus issued a proclamation. Jewish people, you can come back from exile, back to the promised land of Israel. He was a benevolent dictator, Cyrus, an amazing person, allowed the Jewish people to return and rebuild the temple. So we have the rise of the Persian Empire. And there were those Jews who returned, minority returns, with the prophet Nehemiah in the month of Nisan, Passover time. And then we see that foundations are laid for the second temple. They actually begin construction of said second temple. Doesn't work well because a year or so later, King Ahasuerus, our King Ahasuerus from our story of Purim, with perhaps one of Haman's sons, you know, the 10 sons who were so famously hanged and put in the town square. One of them, along with Ahasuerus, issues an edict, because Ahasuerus becomes the new king of most, but not all, of the empire. Stop construction. The Jews are not allowed to continue with this project for the second temple. Halted. Boom. Then in the year 3391, and this is where you don't have to get hung up in the years because there's different opinions about this, but we have the famous banquet, the big party that we're going to talk about tonight in Shushan, using the vessels of the first temple. And then, of course, as a result of that banquet, all the story of Purim happens. You have Mordechai and Esther, and then eventually, at the end of the book of Esther, you have a child, a progeny of Queen Esther and Ahasuerus, and his name is Darius, Daryavesh. And he allows the Jewish people to return to Israel en masse. The second temple is completed 70 years after its destruction. We have the rise of the great Alexander of Macedonia, and then the establishment of prayers, the end of the era of the prophets. No more prophecy. And really, that's another major reason why the book of Esther, I believe, speaks to us today in our current situation. Because we don't see God unless you kind of look between the cracks. And this is the end of prophecy. And in fact, the rabbis say that Esther was the end of prophecy. Now, the name Esther, of course, is not her real name. Her real born name was Hadassah. Hadassah, beautiful name. Why is she called Esther? Why is the book called Esther? So it speaks to the nature of God's appearance in our world. We call it Hester Panim, that God hides his face. That the relationship between God and his people and between the world is one where you have to kind of look at the little details of the world, the cracks of the world, but you don't see overt miracles anymore. It's the end of overt miracles. Now you might say, is this a good thing, bad thing, indifference? Well, we'll explore it tonight, but I just to set up the stage for tonight, I think that in the end it's actually a good thing. Because miracles are wonderful. You know, it's like going to Disney World, Disneyland. You say, oh, it's magic of Disney. It's very awe-inspiring. But at the end of the day, leaves one wanting. Now, I want you to think about something. I'll just choose last week's Torah reading because it's one of the most famous miracles in history, so much so that, you know, it became part of the lexicon. Yul Brynner, Charlton Heston, the Ten Commandments, right? Splitting the Red Sea. So how did things work after the splitting of the Red Sea? You'd think, well, oh my gosh, Jewish people are there. They see the vanquishment of the entire army of Pharaoh, and they sing Shira, the song of the sea, and it's great. Oh, wonderful. But if you look beyond the story of the sea, which not a lot of people do, and study the verses that take you from the sea to the end of this last week's Torah portion, Bishalach, things don't go so well, right? People are complaining, like Jews like to do. First, they complain about the water in a place called Mara. They complain about the food, right? It's like the one Jew on the desert island, the Robinson Crusoe, who builds the two synagogues. You know, this is the one I pray at. That's the one I don't pray at. The Jewish syndrome, right? Two Jews and three Athenians. And you have this. And you go from the sea to the end of the parsha. Now, remarkably, who makes his first appearance at the very end of this last week's parsha? Same person who is the villain in our story, the guy with the triangle hat. Amalek. Yeah. Amalek comes in this last parsha, and it's actually the Torah reading on the day of Purim. So it's all interconnected in a very amazing way, right? So you go from the sea to the arrival of the ancestors of Haman. Now, what are the Haman people responding to, Amalekites? They're responding to a question that we asked out loud. Is God in our midst or not? They didn't say, is there a God? It's a different question. You can't say, is there a God, when you just witnessed the sea splitting and all the miracles that are overt every day. You have the manna come down with your morning New York Times, the Wall Street Journal right there by the door of your tent. It's kind of hard to say, gee, is there a God? That wasn't their question. Hayesh Hashem bikirbeinu im ayin. Is there God in me? Now, think about it for a moment. If you don't have a place for God in your soul, in your heart, then it's a rhetorical question. And it was just voicing the question, is God in me or not? You already have the answer. Of course not. If you can ask that question, then obviously there's no space in your heart for God. So God's obviously not with you. So the Amalekites respond to this, right? And what do we do in response to an Amalekite unprovoked attack? We start to say, oh my gosh, God, please help us, right? Which is always what happens. Whenever the enemies attack, the Jewish people unite, and we repel the enemy. I mean, if only, it's a secret, don't spread this rumor, but if the enemies of Israel would only understand, just leave us alone, that we have more problems trying to get along on our own, but as soon as external pressure is brought to bear, what happens with Jewish people? We don't get hung up on who's, you know, who's right wing, who's left wing, who's Orthodox, who's Reform, who's, right? We just say, a Jews in need, really? Jewish people in France are suffering? Let's get together, let's make a difference, right? Every time. And this is no different. And it begins right here in our story of the attack of Haman and his ancestors all. Now let's get back to the miracle issue, okay? So how do you go from miracles of the Red Sea to is there God in our midst? So you see that miracles don't really cut it. Now think about it. What does a miracle mean for a moment? Just a step back. Miracle means, we're not talking about a football metaphor, okay? Like the Tennessee Titans and the Houston Oilers famous miracle, for those of you who are football fans. We're not talking about like a miraculous last moment touchdown, okay? What we're talking about is that God has set up a world, we call it nature. Genesis, Bereshit. And then God steps back and says, things will work out. because I've created a world. We're embedded in every fiber of the DNA of humans and of animals and trees and nature. Things will work out. But what happens when things don't work out? When the Jewish people are about to get killed at the Red Sea, what is God forced to do? He's forced to interject himself into this world and say, well, you know, things aren't quite going the way I need to. So the big hand metaphorically comes down from heaven and plucks you out. Boom, you have to be rescued. Now, to a thinking person, you might say, well, that was in a great laser light show. I was really knocked for a loop. It was amazing. But if I don't see the hand of God in my life every day, what does that mean? Where's God? Is he an absentee landlord, so to speak? So that's the problem with miracles, right? Is that miracles are great, yes. They're a necessity when the Jewish people are suffering. Absolutely. But if they're a daily occurrence, they cease to be meaningful to a thinking person. Because a thinking person's process should be, wait a minute, if miracles are 0.001% of the time, what about the other 99.99% of the time that God doesn't have to interject? Where is God exactly? Which was the question voiced by the Jewish people right before Amalek comes. Does this make sense to everyone? In other words, think about it. Nature versus miracle means things are not working out the way they should. God, the master of the universe, has to interject himself. So it's not a positive thing. It actually is a negative to a thinking person. Because if there's no God doing miracles, and that's one of the problems, that miracles don't create faith. It's the faith that creates miracles. Does that make sense? The faith of the Jewish people to plunge into the sea created the miracle to see. So that's the cause and effect, is the faith. The emunah, the faith of a person, creates a miracle, potentially. Right? I'm going to do it. Oh, wait a minute. You can't win this war in 1947. You don't have any weapons. The bad guys have tons of weapons. Okay, but we're here. There was a Holocaust. We're going to fight to the death. Whatever. It's going to happen. Guess what? It happened, right? I mean, I was in Israel. I went to Davidka Square. Anyone know what the Davidka was? It was this big, huge, like, anti-tank weapon that made a hellacious amount of noise when it would shoot. It had the accuracy where if you were standing on the Atlantic Ocean, you couldn't hit it on the pier, you wouldn't get into the Atlantic. Okay? It hit nothing. But it made a lot of noise, scared a lot of would-be Arab killers into running away. So they actually have a little place called Kikar Davidka in Jerusalem with one of the Davidkas there. Made a lot of noise. They didn't have any weapons. They would literally drop things that, you know, that made bomb sounds out of the airplanes to scare the enemies. So if you would be rational and say, well, I can't fight this. Look at the statistics. Look at the ground warfare. I can't win this war. That wasn't the attitude. The attitude was, let's go. We'll see what the end result will be. That's really what Purim was about, because Purim is the first time where the name God does not appear in the entire book. There are hints and allusions to perhaps the name of God, yes. You will do not find the Yud-Gay-Fav-Kay, the ineffable name of God, anywhere in the text. Now, is that a coincidence? Of course not. When Esther Mordechai have it written, it's written specifically without the name of God to say, this is your world now. So I believe that the story of Purim will resonate and has resonated with us for so many years because it's where we are now. God's not in the picture unless you really look and you believe, right? Okay. Now, just to step back for one moment, let's look at the chronology and why it's so crucial. And then I want to bring up one last thematic element and then we'll jump into the book, okay? Metaphorically speaking. So you have the destruction of the temple, number one, and at the end of our sheet, temple number two. What is the period of time in between? That's the period of time of the 70-year Jeremiah prophecy that you will return. We almost got it in the time of Cyrus, Koresh, the second box that we have. He issued what's called a proclamation. Come back. That was stopped preemptively by Ahasuerus and one of Haman's sons. Now, why is this so important? It's critical. You see, the non-Jewish people in our story, the bad guys, they also believed in this Jeremiah prophecy. I guess Jeremiah, they saw him at the Mohegan Sun, and they saw that, you know, every time he played the roulette wheel, whatever, he was really good, right? He does the Super Bowl, you know, the Super Bowl lottery. He was really, really good. By the way, it's interesting that our whole story is all about a lottery, right? That's another story. So, because Purim means lottery, literally. So you have Jeremiah issuing a proclamation 70 years. Now, the non-Jewish people are not stupid. So the first guy to try to say, well, maybe the time has passed at the 70 years and the Jewish people haven't gotten by. You know who that was? Famous guy, Belshazzar, who took over the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar from his dad. And the famous story is that he took out those same vessels that Ahasuerus took out that used to belong to God in the temple, the gold vessels. And he felt, hey, 7 years have passed. There's no return of the Jews to Israel. Ah! In your face, God. Let's get the golden stuff out. Let's have a big party. He doesn't manage to live through the night. He's killed. Not a good thing for Belshazzar. Why is that? Because Belshazzar made the 70-year calculation in error from the point of time that Nebuchadnezzar becomes the king. Oops, didn't get it right. Okay, so we fast forward to Ahasuerus in 3391, and he has this amazing banquet, lasts 6 months. 6 months, he has a 180-day party. And then he has an extra 7-day party, only for the best and the brightest of his kingdom. 7 days. And what does he do on the seventh day? He brings out those same golden vessels at the temple, and he thinks it's safe to say, Dathka, right? In your face, God. What's his 7-year calculation? His is based on the exile of the king Jehoiachin, who was the king of Judah, who was exiled to Babylonia. He made the calculation. That's the exile. That's the 70 years. Guess what? Jews are still scattered everywhere. They haven't been redeemed. Safe to go and make use of God's temple items. Not a good thing. Didn't work out so well for Ahasuerus and for Haman. Right. The real 70 years, believe it or not, was actually from the ninth of Av, Tisha B'Av. It was from the destruction of the temple, not King Nebuchadnezzar's rise to power, not the Judean king Jehoiachin's exile to Babylonia, but they made a mistake, and the 70 years was supposed to be calculated from the destruction, what we call the Korban Beit HaMikdash, Solomon's temple.
Why was one killed for it and one wasn't?
Well, that's a separate question. It's an interesting question. Ahasuerus clearly used the golden, you know, vessels, but he was also himself a vessel used by everybody in our story. So it's interesting. We'll have to answer that question. It's a great question, Bruce. But think about Ahasuerus. Belshazzar was killed that night.
By.
It's a famous story in Daniel. It's kind of a little bit off the scope of our. He was murdered that night. Okay. But why is this germane? Because the whole story. The Jews elect to defy their chief rabbi, Mordechai, who is the head of the Jewish population of the new capital of the Persian Empire, Shushan. Now, Shushan had only been very temporarily the new, it was sort of like Brasilia, where they create this city out of nowhere in Brazil that was man-made, and it sort of, you know, kicks Rio and Sao Paulo out of the realm. It was very a new thing. Shushan had never been the capital. It was just the capital in the time of Ahasuerus. It had always been another capital in Babylonia. It became the epicenter for all cultural life. And it was Ahasuerus' turn to show off his greatness to the people. And we'll discuss this tonight. What was the mindset about? And what happened is he invited the Jews of Shushan to come partake in the party. Mordechai said, you dare not go. They're using the temple's vessels. If you go, you're going to condemn the Jewish people to who knows what. Of course, many went, tragically. And some say that this was one of the reasons that the decree of Haman was allowed to take such monumental proportions and almost destroy the Jewish people because of this horrible sin that the Jewish people were allowed, that they allowed themselves to be invited and partake in this party using God's temple's own golden vessels. This was a really, really, it's one thing for a non-Jewish king to use them, but for the Jews to partake of that party, no, that's a really bad thing. Okay, lastly, before we get into our story, something I just want to share with you. So just to reiterate, we've talked about the end of miracles and how this really fits our day and age, and that's why I believe this story is so profound and resonates with so many of us. Secondly, what I want to talk about is just a question I'm going to throw out there for you to think about, and we'll try to answer this in 3 weeks henceforth. Why do we call that holiday Purim? Now, the word Purim means lots, lottery. And the Megillah tells us, as you'll see at the end of the Megillah, why is it called Purim? Because of the lottery that Haman used to determine the date, the month, and the day to destroy the Jewish people. Now, that does not make a whole lot of sense if you analyze it in a very deep way. For example, 1948, we talked about the War of Independence for a moment, you know, earlier. Let's just pretend that we have a day called Yom Ha'atzma'ut, Israel Independence Day, that we all love, correct? Well, what if we didn't call it Yom Ha'atzma'ut? What if we call it the Day of the Kalashnikov? Why? Because that was the weapon that the would-be persecutors and murderers of all the Jews, that the Arabs who fought that war against the Israel, that was their main weapon, was the Kalashnikov. I don't think it was the Kalashnikov. It was the precursor to the Kalashnikov. I'm just using the AK-47. So let's call the holiday after the weapon of war used by the enemies in an attempt to destroy the Jewish people. So let's call it Kalashnikov Day. Think about it. Purim? Because Haman uses the lottery to try to destroy the Jewish people. He doesn't win. So let's call the holiday, the whole festival, after the method, the MO, that our would-be vanquisher used to destroy the Jews. Does that make any sense at all? I would say not. Now, I'm sure you haven't thought about that. That's why I'm here tonight, to try to share with this with you. So what I'd like to do is, in a couple of weeks, we'll try to revisit why Purim is called Purim. And you'll see in the end that it's remarkable. There's a duality. Yes, it is called Purim because of Haman, but there's another reason that I think will work in tandem, and that will show you the two different sides of the story, okay? Lastly, as we're going to learn, you're going to see something very interesting, I hope. Many of us were exposed to the story as children. I will assure you this is not a children's story. I'm not saying it's R-rated, but there are parts that are very much R-rated. There are very much parts that you would never teach a little child. And there's so much to the story that to not look at it as an adult and as a thinking, mature person is really a disservice to the book itself and to ourselves. I'll give you one example. My Rosh Hashanah, my Rebbe, pointed this out. It's a little out there, but it's interesting, okay? Little Jewish girls traditionally dress up as who?
Esther.
And What do they always have in the little story? They go to the beauty contest that they have, and little Esther's chosen to be the queen. And it's all really nice and innocent, right? There's only one small problem. Well, anyone know what's the small problem? That the beauty contest wasn't exactly a little benign beauty contest. We tell the children, of course, because they're little kids. Does anyone know what it really was about? It was essentially a state-sanctioned rape fest. These girls were coerced. They were brought by Ahasuerus. They were taken to the palace in Shushan against their will, whether they liked it or not. They had to spend one night with the king, whether they liked it or not. And essentially, they were thrown to the harem, and they became a prostitute for him. And the harem probably, unless he asked for them by name, they were never seen. They were given, you know, their perfumes and their oils and a little bank account somewhere in Switzerland. Bye. Now, this is not exactly what we tell our children, correct? Otherwise, I don't think so many Jewish little girls would be dressing up, you know. Of course, so we very much take the real part of the story that the Talmud and the other commentaries talk about, and we try to color code it for the children to make it palatable. But we as adults are going to endeavor to go beyond the simple way of looking at the story. I think we'll see a whole another secretive story, because how could a book called Esther, Hidden, where the whole heroine, that's the huge issue, she hides her identity. That's the issue of the story. And it's the issue of the story going forward, right? That God hides his countenance from the world. This is not a small issue. And if that's true, there must be a lot of hidden things that are for us to explore and try to find out about. Okay? So let us begin in our Book of Esther. Yes, Larry.
Just a question. I always thought that the story of Esther took place locally. His locale was Persia.
Correct.
And
Shushan was the capital, the new capital of the Persian Empire.
Okay, and what was the transition from when the Jews were in exile from Babylon to Persia?
Oh, very good, thank you. Well, it doesn't go into this whole, there's a lot there, but essentially the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar was taken over by Cyrus of Persia. When Cyrus dies, Ahasuerus eventually takes over and has the 127 provinces and kingdoms that are under his domain. Okay? So Ahasuerus inherits Cyrus's, who then in return had taken over Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian kingdom. And the transfer of the locale of the capital from Babylonia to Shushan, Persia, which is a huge thing. I mean, can you imagine moving the capital city? Is not a small issue that happens. So there's a lot going on. I didn't want to I mean, I could have spent 2 hours tonight just contextualizing the history of it.
The reason I brought that up was because I always personally equate the current situation and, you know, the where things change and they're the same with the Iranian and the nuclear, the story of Esther.
Well, it takes place in essentially the same locale.
You know, we're in Haman, and we're doing the same. We're relating the same thing again, which is to me why this is so important. I mean,
I hear. It's very well said. It's very. And tragically, you're absolutely right, Larry. I mean, you're making a very poignant moment.
Iran
I mean,
wants to start the Persian Empire again.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
The Israeli
well, they're in the process of rebuilding it, but they have also the same. Haman objective.
Sure. And they have this obsessive desire. I mean, there's one little difference, is that they claim it's all about Israel and the Jews. It's not 100% true. Publicly it is, because it plays better to say, I hate the Zionists, I worry about the poor Palestinian Arabs, and, you know, everything's for them, right? Although, you notice pre-1948, there was no issue of the Palestinian Arabs, right? Nobody worried about them. When King Hussein decided to murder them all and throw them out of Jordan in Black September 1970, I don't think anybody worried too much in the Arab world. But when Israel's there, they were occupying their territory. But that said, we all know who the number one enemy of Iran is, and they're called the Saudi Arabian Empire. But that's the real, I mean, it's a little game of the shell game. Remember Three Card Monty? The game they used to play in New York where the guy has the little three cards, two red, like one red and two black, and he's turning them over. So that's the game, right? That you show the card with the Jewish picture because it plays better in the Persian and Arab media and Al Jazeera et al. But the real guys who they're targeting and who they hate, Iran versus Saudi Arabia, that's the real game. I mean, knowing people understand this. In fact, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Saudis have actually contracted their friends in Pakistan to build them multiple nuclear weapons. And they're being stored currently in Pakistan because Saudi Arabia doesn't want to become an officially nuclear country. And the moment that Iran, God forbid, would declare itself a nuclear entity, Saudi Arabia will then bring the weapons to Saudi Arabia, and then the world changes. Okay? I mean, suffice it to say. Thank you for bringing that up. Chapter 1, page 18. So the famous opening, Vayehi b'nei Achashverosh, and it was in the days of Achashverosh. Of course, the famous joke goes, you read it like in Hebrew, Vayehi b'nei Achashverosh, and it was in the days of King Achashverosh. And then someone yells out, who? I don't know who he is. Who? What? So then the Megillah says, oh, I have to tell you who he was, because I know you don't know who Achashverosh was. Who Achashverosh? Hamalech Mehoduvad Kush? Oh, yeah. It's the same guy named Achashverosh who ruled the world from Hodu, from India, to Kush in Africa, Ethiopia area, Sheva Vesrim Vemeah Medina, 127 different provinces. Now, it's very, very interesting that it says Vayehi b'nei Achashverosh. Now, whenever any text in the Torah begins with the word Vayehi, this is not a good thing, because Vayehi, according to the rabbis, is the same as oy vey. And it was is never a good thing. It's oy vey, something bad is coming this way. Every time you look throughout all of Tanakh, whenever they use the Vayehi, many, many times it's going to be a guy with a triangle hat or his equivalent is on the way. Something not nice is coming your way. Now, why does it say, Hu Achashverosh Hamolech? Who reigned? As if he made himself the king. So the rabbis in the Talmud say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Let's talk a little bit about Achashverosh, okay? Let's take a little time out, talk about Achashverosh. Achashverosh was not of regal ancestry at all. He was an outsider. He made himself the king. He wasn't, as is common in rest of the world, he wasn't the heir to the throne of his father. He wasn't the firstborn pharaoh or Charles or any of the other monarchs? No. He was the one Hamolech. He made himself king over others. He used his brain power. He used his money. He used persuasion and political savvy to make himself the king. Now, why is this not a small issue? Because as the Megillah unfolds, his own persona is very critical to the whole story. Because remember, if he's like the great-grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, then he's like, hey, come on, my granddaddy, my Zaidi was the man, he was Nebuchadnezzar. But if he's just some guy off the street, essentially, who doesn't have any royal blood in his veins, he's not a blue blood, right? He's just one of the guys. then it becomes an issue of ego, of sensitivity. And by the end of the story, he's already become like a paranoid lunatic, right? By the point in the story where Esther says to Mordechai, anyone who goes into the king, even the king's own wife, the queen, gets their head chopped off if there's no invitation, unless the sharvit, unless the scepter's lifted. How did he get to that mindset? Well, Haman poisoned his mind, because Haman was brilliant. But Ahasuerus himself became like a paranoid lunatic by that time in the story. Why is this? Well, we're going to see it unfold. Now, his wife is a very beautiful woman. Thomas says that Vashti, the queen, contrary to the way we portray Vashti in all the little plays, was an drop-dead gorgeous woman on the outside. Inside, her soul, if you could have been privy to her soul, was very dark and a bad place to be. Vashti, though, was a real queen. Her grandfather was King Nebuchadnezzar. Her father was Belshazzar. So she had real blue blood in her veins. So by marrying Vashti, not only did he get a gorgeous wife, but he got a queen who became Mother Persia, ostensibly, for all of his empire, and who connected the empire back to Belshazzar and Nebuchadnezzar, which cemented the poll numbers for Ahasuerus' new kingdom, right? So having a wife who had the yichus, who had the genealogy, was not a small issue for him. Now, the problem was that he was very sensitive to himself, because he knows that he's a nobody and his wife is a somebody. That's a very big issue in the first chapter when she defies him and does not come to the party. Okay, it's a big issue. Now, Ahasuerus has 127 kingdoms. So what does he decide to do? He decides to have the party to end all parties. And he invites, as you see in the Megillah, I'll just read it in English, okay? Number two, that in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Shushan the capital, meaning it wasn't previously in Shushan the capital, the capital, as we said, had only been moved at that point to Shushan, in the third year of his reign as the king, he made a feast for all his officials and his servants, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and officials of the province and being present, when he displayed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days. So he had a six-month party. Now, when these days were fulfilled, the six-month party is over, the king made a week-long feast, additionally, beyond the 6 months, for all the people who were present in Shushan the capital, Shushan HaBira, great and small alike, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And then it goes through you can read through all the beauty of the decor and the party. It said that they had a wine. Are you ready for this? I love this one. It says that a wine, everyone had their own wine. And it was predicated on your age. It had to be at least 1 year older than you were. So if a person was aged, you needed a wine 1 year beyond you. And there were no limitations to your drinking. That was whole of the party. Food, drinking, beyond parel. He wanted to show off in a very much of a PR mode. He was a brilliant guy, Ahasuerus. He's often portrayed in little stories as a buffoon. Not quite. Pretty sharp guy. And it's all political agenda here. To show off himself, the new kingdom, his palace, his wife, in the most positive way, to cement his poll numbers, because representatives from all 127 kingdoms and states are all attending this massive party. So it's critical. Therefore, on the day number 7, where he is drunk and asks his queen to appear, and she does not appear, it undermines everything he has done.
Did you show up for all 6 months, or did they
show up
for 7 days?
It's not clear. The seven days in Shushan is the issue, because that's when he brought out the kelim, the holy vessels of the temple. That was the big issue, at least in God's mind and in Mordechai's mind. Okay? Now, let's go down to verse number 9. So Vashti, the queen, has her area of the palace where she is in charge, and she has her own little party for the ladies. Okay? Seventh day, critical day, Shabbat. It was Shabbat. It was Shabbos. When the heart of the king was merry with wine, he ordered, and it says the names of his people, his chamberlains, to bring Vashti the queen before the king wearing the royal crown, to show off to the people and the officials her beauty, for she was beautiful to look upon. When it says the royal crown, the rabbis in the Talmud have a big discussion about what that means, but clearly she's wearing perhaps only the royal crown, meaning she was asked to come without any clothes. That's one possibility. Okay? And she was okay with that. That wasn't an issue. Or at least the royal crown would connect back Vashti, Mother Persia, his kingdom would cement in the minds of the people of the Hadith, because this is their first experience with this new king. Remember, not only is this the only opportunity, what do they always say, you only get one chance to make a first impression? So this is big, okay? Because this is his moment to introduce himself to the world. So for her to undermine it in such a profound way has tremendous ramifications for his kingdom going forward, okay? Now, he orders her to come, but Vashti says in verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment, conveyed by the chamberlains. The king therefore became very incensed, and his anger burned in him. And as any good king will do, he wants to talk to his king's council. What should be done? Because if someone gives him stupid advice, it's nice to have other heads roll and not his own. So he has seven people who are apparently those who were the Yoei Tse Lamelech, the advisors to the king, and he lists them. Karshinah, Shesar, this is in verse 14, Admasa, Tarshish, Meres, Marsana, and Memuchan. Stop at the word Memuchan. So the rabbis in the Talmud and Megillah say, who was Memuchan? So some say it was the prophet Daniel. Okay, that's one opinion. But the more normative opinion is that Memuchan is actually our introduction to Mr. Triangle Hat. Memuchan is a euphemism for Haman. Now he's number seven at this point, way down the pecking order in the council of the king. So he's not exactly the viceroy, the prime minister. He becomes the second most powerful man in the land. He's like a little bit of a lowly guy in the back. So what happens? King is drunk. King is drunk, and you know what they say about someone drunk? When the wine comes in, the secrets come out. You are ready to react on a razor's edge. So the rabbis in the Talmud say he actually summoned the Jews first. He said, what do you say, rabbis? What should be done? I ordered my queen to come. The queen said, I'm not coming. There's a lot of backstory to this, but suffice it to say that don't feel too sorry for Vashti, because Vashti was a wicked, wicked person who loved to belittle and hurt little Jewish girls. He would have them come and work for her, especially on Shabbat, it says, and he would force the Jewish girls to be mechalel Shabbat, to desecrate the Shabbat. And her payback was that she was summoned on Shabbat and lost her head, ostensibly, on Shabbat. Mita keneged mita, quid pro quo. Okay? So do not shed any tears for Vashti. Vashti was willing to come. It wasn't an issue for her to appear either with or without clothing, whatever the issue might be. But what was the issue? So some say that she had like a little bit of outbreak of some boils or some this. Whatever the issue was, she wasn't looking her most fine. And she said, oh my gosh, I got to defend myself to the king. So she sends a message to the king. Not only am I not coming, this is beautiful, it's lovely. This is what you do to a guy who is a little bit insane with PR at this moment. And you send a letter to be read publicly in front of all his... Remember, he's in the room with all the most personal, most biggest machers, you know, the biggest guys to be found in the land, and they're all drunk. And what precipitated the discussion, according to the rabbis in the Talmud, was that one of the kings opened his mouth, the lowlier kings under Ahasuerus, and talked about how beautiful his women were. And pretty soon everyone was chiming in on how beautiful their own women were. And Ahasuerus said, oh, come on, you guys, I'm sure your wives are okay. But the ladies of Persia, oh my gosh, they're drop-dead gorgeous. And I married the most beautiful of all, which was true, Vashti. And he summons Vashti, and Vashti was willing to go. But then at the point where Vashti can't go without it becoming a personal PR problem for herself, if she's not looking her most beautiful, her makeup cannot hide the boils that are afflicting her, she sends a very indignant letter back to the king. Tell the king that, you know what? I love these words, by the way. This is the Talmud. Megillah says this. Tell the king that, you know, if my granddad, Nebuchadnezzar, was around today, he couldn't get a job as a stable boy working for my grandfather. That's what I think of him as a king. And I always imagine, you know, like the emissary, the FedEx guy, who has to bring the message back from Vashti and read it out loud in front of Ahasuerus there in the palace, the poor guy. You know the expression of kill the message, shoot the messenger. Probably not a good job to have, right? So the king is incensed. He calls the rabbis in. Rabbis, what say you? What should be done? Now, so the rabbis are very smart. They step outside. They say, excuse me, your royal highness, we have a little time out here. And they step outside. They say, we're in big trouble here. Because obviously the king is incensed. And he's drunk. And he's ready to have her head. He wants permission to have her head. But if we give him license, then tomorrow when he wakes up, not only will he have a 12 Advil headache from the hangover of the wine, but he's then going to somehow remind himself of Vashti and why he did what he did to Vashti. It's the Jews who suggested this. So whatever we say, if we say now do nothing, he'll take it out on us now. No respect for the crown. Like Roddy Dangerfield, right? No respect at all. But if we tell him kill her, then tomorrow he'll take it out on us. So they did the smartest thing in the world, which was to say nothing. They said, you know, we're not sure. Ask somebody smarter and better. And at that point, he asks the seven men of the council, and everyone's kind of like, oh my gosh, this is bad. We're not weighing in. And at the back of the room, the man in the triangle hat for the very first time says, you know, not only is it an insult to the king directly what Vashti did, it's an insult to the manhood of every thinking man walking this planet Earth in the Persian Empire. Because when word gets out that the queen defies the king and there's no consequence, think of it. Oh my gosh, women's lib, it's going to be horrible, right? Women's going to ask for voting rights. We never know where it's going to end, right? So we better make an example here for the queen. Now, at this moment, by following Haman, or Memuchan, as we're calling him now, and I will explain to you in a moment why we call him by this euphemism, which is a very powerful reason, Haman's advice and the king's willingness to jump into bed with the man with the triangle hat, metaphorically speaking, means that at this point, Haman starts to become a player, because the king fully invests his future in Haman's vision of the empire. Haman's a very smart guy. Say what you want about Haman, smart he was. Okay, sound a little like Yoda. Smart he was. He was a very bright man. So what happens? The king invests fully. It's not clear what happens to Vashti. She is exiled. She's sent away to some little island, or she's killed. There's an argument. Wherever she went, or whatever her outcome, most likely she was killed. There was no return from where she was, because obviously there would be no story if somehow you can call Vashti back and say, oops, I forgive you, honey. What? Some say she lost her head. It's not so clear. It doesn't really say. If you look at the text, it doesn't really say what happened, right? All it says, look carefully what happened, right? That she was brought, right? But it doesn't say what exactly happened to her, okay, at least in the text itself. Okay?
Who asked you?
It really doesn't tell what happened. Okay? It just says that Vashti never again appear in verse 19 before King Ahasuerus. Right? Doesn't really say what happened. But like you say, I think the common understanding is that she probably was taken out back like Ceausescu was in Romania, and, you know, the deed was done. Remember Emperor, you remember the evil Ceausescu? They took him out with a firing squad. They sentence him and they say goodbye, remember? It was a very funny moment, actually, in a very dark way. Do you remember who Ceausescu, the Romanian evil despot, was? And Ceausescu was ahead in the time of the old, you know, evil empire. He ran Romania, tortured everybody, killed everybody in the Romanian empire. So I remember there was a member of his personal guard squad, and he was recounting the last moments of Ceausescu. They put him on trial, and they killed him that day. And he said, they asked for volunteers. And the man says, and everybody in the room put up their hand, you know, who wants to be part of the firing squad, you know? I remember the way he said it. Everybody volunteered. So everyone volunteered, let's get rid of Vashti. And not only did they get rid of Vashti, but they send out an insane letter at the end of chapter 1. And why do I say it's insane? Listen to the text of the letter. You tell me if this sounds a little over the top. Okay, this is number 20. Then, when the king's decree which he shall proclaim shall be resounded throughout all his kingdom, great though it be, that all the wives, meaning not only the queen, but every husband and wife in the kingdom, all wives shall show respect to the husbands, great and small alike. What? Now, this was the first time that Ahasuerus in his new empire had ever had an official correspondence that he sent out. So the husbands get this correspondence. I'm sure it came with pomp and circumstance, you know, the trumpet blowing as the king's man rides in his horse into each little village, each little town. A message from the king, right? Everybody assembles there in the town square. And essentially the message is, be strong, be a man, stand up to your wife. Now this is way before, you know, feminism, women's lifts. So this was like
I'm saying, but this was, right.
I mean, Jackie Gleason, by comparison, was a forward-thinking individual. These guys, women had nothing back then. They had, you know, burkas were unsneistic, immodest back then. You know, women had no rights back then. So the idea that men would need to be told this by their king was strange. But what was important about the letter, what the rabbis and the Talmud say, is that because it's the first communique, if the first communique doesn't have its desired impact, meaning the people don't say, oh my gosh, brilliant king, oh, what a great law, I agree. But rather they're scratching their head thinking, okay, I understand, he's a little oversensitive because his own queen, you know, didn't come and it was embarrassing, but this should be the first igeret, the first letter sent out in the name and the royal seal of the king. Be a man? What? And this is not a small issue. Can I explain why? Listen to this. What was the next letter sent out in the name of the king? Kill the Jews. Be ready for the 13th day of Adar. We're going to exterminate the Jews. So the Talmud tells us that if not for the buffoonery of the first letter, they would not have waited till Adar 13, months later in the future. They would have received this communique from the king who they held in high esteem, not as a buffoon, and they would have said, well, why wait? I don't like the Jews anyways. I want their property and their, I want everything Jewish. Let's just kill them now. Why wait for next Adar 13? What saved them? The first letter saved them, because the first letter paints a picture of a king who's a little bit of a buffoon and can't even control his own wife and finds it necessary to send out a communique to that effect. So when they get the next communication from the king, now of course it was Haman who crafted the communication and had the king's ring, correct? They didn't know that. They thought it's right from the king himself. So they scratch their head and say, wait a minute, what if the king, you know, like what if he changes his mind? The same king with that stupid idiot who couldn't control his wife. Okay, fine. We'll kill the Jews, sure. But I'm not going to make a preemptive strike against the Jews. So that letter, in the end of chapter 1, actually saves the day for the Jews. That allows a window of opportunity for Mordechai and Esther to work their magic. Yes?
So I thought Haman was the, it was his idea to kill the Jews. And not
Ahasuerus.
And that's why Ahasuerus...
It's a tough word. Ahasuerus.
Consulting the Jews because he, like others, believed in the prophecy
of Jeremiah.
So he himself is not anti-Semitic per se. It was Haman who planted that.
Correct. And we'll discuss that the next class. You're making a very good point. That's a very much debated question. How much was Ahasuerus? Where did his feelings stop, and where do Haman's begin? We know what Haman's feelings are.
Today,
right.
With BBC and everything, I mean, this is, you know,
right,
going on in multiple.
Exactly. Exactly. It's very unclear. There's no question Ahasuerus was not a fan of the Jews. Now, was he an overt anti-Semite? That's the debate. Haman, undoubtedly. Haman, though. Right, but here's the thing. Haman's brilliance is that he gave the advice and threw it out there. The king could then process and claim it as his own. So it almost became, rather than foisted on a king, he felt it was organically his own idea. So therefore, Haman manipulated. They said nobody, the Talmud says nobody in the history of the world ever blasphemed and told lashon hara, evil speech, slandered a people the way Haman did. But he was so brilliant that he never, as you'll see next week, he never comes out and says the Jews should be killed. He doesn't even identify them. He calls them the Am. There's a people who are mixed up and scattered. He never says the Jews. Never, ever, ever. Brilliant man.
Ahasuerus couldn't have hated them that much because he invited them to the party. You know, you wanted them to come in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
Well, I mean, they were there. I think part of it, though, Jason, to answer your question, I think you're right. But part of it's also he wanted representation because this was his moment to show off.
Yeah.
And it was necessary that the Jews may not be his favorites, with which they weren't, but it's also a shtoch to the Jews to have their own vessels there and to say, the Jews, I'm going to put you in a no-win situation. Your king is inviting you to partake of my meal. Okay, fine, God's temple's holy vessels are there. You're going to come. You're going to show more respect to me, the king, or to your own king in heaven. That was a big issue. But you're right. That's a very good point. Okay. So at the end of chapter one, the letter is sent out. People scratch their head. What's going on with the new king? We don't quite understand. Now, I have promised you an explanation of Haman's name. Why do they call him then? Memuchan. So the word Memuchan might be a word you may know from the Haggadah. Because on Passover, there's a little tiny paragraph. It's, you need like a electron microscope to see it. But right before each of the cups of wine, we say, Hinini Memuchan u'mizuman, right? We are prepared and ready to perform the mitzvah of whatever cup of wine we're going to drink. And then we drink the cup. So the word Memuchan comes from the Hebrew Muchan, Hachana, to prepare. So the rabbis tell us that Mr. Haman was the singularly most prepared individual in the history of the world. Nobody ever prepared every single detail to destroy, to commit a genocide, to commit a Holocaust, probably until his great-grandchildren, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, who you know were Mr. Detail. I mean, nobody, right? Every little detail of the final plan, as they call it, you know, Eichmann, Yimach Shemo, and Hitler, the final solution, I mean, every detail had to be, you know, the trains ran on time, you know, the famous stories, right? That's what the Germans were like. So Haman was obviously their great-great-grandfather, if not literally, and then for sure in terms of spirit. So there's no question that he was Mr. Preparation. And of course, the ultimate irony is, the Talmud says, why is he called Mr. Preparation? Because he was prepared to take a fall. Muchan lefuranut. He's going to die. What? So we'll have to find out in future classes, why is he called Mr. Fall Guy? Meaning, ostensibly, whatever Haman would have done would have had the ultimate conclusion. All the work that he did was great for Haman. But if you remember, every little detail that he thought was so brilliant, as in the letter, for example, saves the Jews. What is the greatest symbol of this? The laughable. I mean, when you get to this one of the Megillah, you scratch your head and you have a smile the first time you learn it. Remember? The gallows, right? He's coming and he says, I can't wait. Even though Mordechai, the Jew, is about to get killed, come 13 Adar, that dumb Jew won't bow to me. What am I going to do? He goes to his family, right? Zeresh and the family. What do I do? She says, well, let's kill him now. Why wait, right? And they go through a whole plethora of ways to kill the Jews. None of them seem to have been very successful. You know, beheading and drowning. They go through everything, and every Jew somehow gets through it. Hanging, we haven't tried that one yet. So let's build a gallows. Okay, so he builds a gallows. He builds a gallows so high that it's visible from the window of the palace, of where all the famous story of the party that Esther has for Haman and Ahasuerus. So he can literally look out the window and see the gallows, because it's like 50 amot tall. It's like hundreds of feet tall. And of course, who ends up having a swinging good time on the gallows that he built for Mordechai? Haman. So he gets killed by his own instrument of choice. I mean, it's beautiful. It's lovely. It's delicious, right? We know the turnabout. We actually have a song, V'nahapachu, the turnabout, how everything that he put into place, meaning all the preparation, boom. So we need to take this, by the way, and send it to Ahmadinejad and the leaders in Iran and say, plan all you want, because in the end, it's been done. And whatever you think is going to hurt us, it's going to come back on you double. Yes? You have a comment? Okay, we have exactly 6 more minutes. I don't want to go past an hour. I know it's been a little longer than usual, but I hope you bear with me, because I promised a little bit more of the rise of the man in the triangle hat. So we can close the Megillah for a second. I'll just give you a little background into Haman in the next chapter. Okay? So the next chapter, essentially, we have the story of the rape fest that I alluded to earlier. Right? Where they go from town to town. They need a new mother, Persia. Vashti's dead. Esther is brought. Her name is Hadassah. We're introduced to Mordechai. Mordechai was exiled. It says, Im Yechaniahu, with the king Yoyachin. He was the one, the king of Judah, who was exiled to Babylonia. Who was Mordechai? He was one of the members of the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, the great rabbinical assembly of 120 rabbis. So he's a great, great person. And he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And interestingly, and this is another reason perhaps, why this story resonates with us so much, he's really the first person in the Torah described as a Jew. Because remember, in Egypt, we're not called Jews. We're called the Bnei Israel, the children of Israel. Correct? Yehuda is one of 12 tribes. Ah, but that changed. When did it change? It changes when the 12 tribes break up, and you have a northern kingdom of the children of Joseph, called the Kingdom of Israel, and then you have the southern kingdom of Judah, which is essentially Judah, Benjamin, and parts of the other tribes. What happened to the northern kingdom? We're not really sure where they went. Those are called the lost tribes. We do know King Sanherib, the Assyrian king, took them and scattered them, so they were gone. And when the kingdom of Judah in the south was taken, there was a huge difference. Nebuchadnezzar did not scatter the Jews. He brought them en masse to one area in Babylonia where they were able to recreate a unique Jewish kingdom, like so to speak, an area, a little ghetto, whatever you want to call it, where Jewish life continued. So they were not scattered. And who were the tribes left? Judah, Benjamin. Now Benjamin was the least populous tribe at this point in time. Because you may have heard of a tragic, tragic story of the story of this woman they describe as Pelegish Begiva, this concubine who was raped and murdered in the area, territory of Benjamin, and there's intertribal warfare goes on. Benjamin's almost exterminated. They live for another day, and Benjamin is the smallest tribe there with Judah. So when we introduce ourselves in the next chapter or so with Mordechai, we say, Ish Yehudi. He's a Jewish man from Judah, but he wasn't from Judah. Because in the same breath, it says, Ish Yemini, a man of Benjamin. Well, you can't be a man of Judah and a man of Benjamin. It's one or the other, right? So he's really the first time we see that there's a Jewish identity. Yehudia, Jews. So it's not about the Israelites, like with Pharaoh. It's about the Jews. Gee, I wonder how does that resonate with us today? It's always about the Yehudim, the Jews, right? Okay. Now let's talk about Haman for a moment, okay? Because he's an interesting person with promisable background. We know about the idea of, in the first chapter, he makes this mysterious appearance without the name. So you don't get to bang your groggers, I'm sorry. I mean, you could. See, a real knowing person, when you hear Mamuchan and Shul, you could, you know, shake the grogger a little bit. And when someone looks at you with the evil eye, you say, come on, I went to Kaplan's class. I remember Mamuchan is Haman, so come on. Right? Let's eradicate the name also. So Haman makes his appearance, and we're introduced to him as Haman, and it gives us Yechus, his genealogy, and it describes him in a very strange way. It says he's an Agagite, Ha'agagi. Ah, anyone learn Samuel here? I believe you did with the past rabbi, right? Some of you went to the Book of Samuel class. Do you remember the war that Samuel and Saul fought against the Amalekite nation? And Saul, if you remember, transgressed God's word. He was told specifically to kill men, women, children of the nation, not to take spoils, even the animals. Did Saul listen? He tragically did not. He allowed the people to take spoils, and the king himself, whose name was Agag, was taken hostage, prisoner. Samuel eventually hears the bleeding of the animals and says, Saul, he says to the king, did you do God's work? He says, well, yeah, absolutely. He says, well, how come I hear like sheep and animals here? Where did they come? Did you make war with your animals? With the sheepala? Like, what's going on? Where do the animals come from? And then he tries to excuse himself. Well, you know, the people pressured me. They want the spoils. And then the king himself's alive. So between the moments that the king was allowed to live in chains, Agag, that was his name, the Amalekite king, till the time that he is cut in half, literally, by Samuel, didn't save the day. Because what happened? He got his wife, or some say a concubine, pregnant. And it's from that union where Haman is born. So it was King Saul's avera, his sin, which creates the potential for the destruction. Hitler, Haman is created. So by connecting him as an Agagite, the Megillah is taking you knowingly all the way back to the story of Saul. Now this is not a small issue. Because can you guess who is the grandfather of Mordechai and Esther? King Saul. Oh my gosh. King Saul is the great-grandfather of Mordechai and Esther. So here you have a multi-generational play. Amazing, right? That is between Saul, who allows Haman's great-grandfather to be born, I mean, to live and therefore Haman to be born by his indecision and neglect of God's command. And then generations later, Haman comes and presents a most clear and present danger to Jewish existence. And it's Saul's progeny, Mordechai and Esther, who are told, get rid of him. Make up for what your great-grandfather did not do. So you see how amazing the whole book comes multi-generationally. It brings us all the way back to Samuel, to King Saul, to King David, to the fight against the Amalekites. And as we pointed out at the beginning of our class tonight, in a very profound way, brings us back to the Red Sea, right? Where we're going from the Red Sea and the Amalekite attack. All of that is brought to bear in this amazing, amazing book. So next week, God willing, we will continue the saga. We have the rise to power now. We have this obscure person named Haman, who is the seventh of the advisors, an inconsequential person. But because the king buys into his vision for removal of Vashti, the letter being sent, he has to buy in everything else. And in a very short order, as we will see next week, Haman rises mercurially to power from this obscure advisor. And pretty soon he is the one planting the message, kill the Jews, without saying, kill the Jews. And then the rest of the story continues. So I wish everyone a wonderful, safe evening. And we're right at